VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, it's the start of Euro 2024 qualifying, with England out in Naples to face Italy. What can we expect from Gareth Southgate's team in the coming months? Will they develop into a team that can go and win a tournament, and how will they do that? And how are you feeling about this team right now? Is it time we're a little bit more optimistic about England, no matter how they perform in the build-up to tournaments? We'll also be discussing where Steve Clarke's Scotland are at the moment, a very important group for them, mainly up against Spain and Norway in terms of those top two spots. Will they make it through to the European Championship? We'll get the latest on the sale of Manchester United and talk a little bit about Mesut Ozil after his retirement as well. This is The Game. Hello and welcome to The Game Podcast. I am Hugh Wisencroft, alongside Tom Clark and Gregor Robertson. Of course, we'll be talking about international football, international break at the moment, and the start of Euro 2024 qualifying. Scotland's come a little bit later on, and an update on Manchester United. But of course, we begin with England, who are out in Naples to face Italy a little bit later on today. They start their campaign against the Italians. They then face Ukraine on Sunday. In an interesting group for them, the top two teams qualify, of course. And also alongside them in Group C, Malta, North Macedonia as well. So I think we should expect England to qualify. And that means that we can maybe look at the bigger picture. Look, that's English arrogance for you. Before a game's been played, I'm already saying we're going through. But you know what I mean? You should be confident, England. Of course, we should be confident of going out of this group. And I think we can look at the wider context of what we learned at the World Cup. And I think what the team should be like going forward, what kind of England team Gareth Southgate can forge over the next 2 years. Before we get to that, let's speak to Matt Lawton, who is out in Naples with England at the moment. Hi, Matt. Hi. I wanted to talk to you about Naples and a lot of the stories that have gone on around this game. Some feeling that it's being held in Naples after what happened at the Euros last summer, maybe to intimidate England a little bit as well, to try and help Italy get off to the best possible start. What have you experienced whilst being out in the city?
Very little, to be honest. A very, very calm, quiet. Tom Roddy and I, my colleague at the Times, we went in search of a cab quite late last night. Our evening was slightly delayed by me being a bit busy with breaking United developments. But yeah, we strolled into the city centre, where, you know, around the areas where the squares are, where the fans were gathering, and this was about 1 a.m. And it was completely quiet. And I checked in with the UK Football Policing Unit guys this morning who are out here, and there were no incidents. So, yeah, look, I've been here since Tuesday, chasing what turns out so far to be a complete non-story. What I would say is that there is a heavy police presence. There's an army presence. I had England fans that I know sending me pictures from the airport yesterday afternoon. There was in the baggage reclaim area, there was, you know, dozens and dozens of Italian police officers who were checking the credentials of all the England fans as they passed. They were asking them where they were staying, proof of their hotel accommodation, tickets. So, they, you know, I do think talking to the UK cops, the Italian cops have been helpful out here. They have organised for buses, free buses from the port to take all the fans, England fans, there's about 2,500-3,000 of them out here, to take them all to the ground and then to bring them back as well, and in a way to ensure their safety. but also to apply a bit of control, obviously. But as I say, so far so good. I don't want to preempt it. It could be horrendous at the game later. But I very much suspect, in the story I wrote a couple of days ago about how belts have been banned, I think the worst thing that's going to happen tonight is lots of builders' backsides everywhere.
What are you, aside from that, what are you expecting tonight in terms of what England may or may not produce? Because I think there has been a lot of conversation so far this week about England. You know, reflections on the World Cup, reflections on the fact that Gareth Southgate has stayed as England's manager. But there is also a backlash coming from Italy, who, of course, missed out on a place at the World Cup for consecutive tournaments. Huge pressure on Roberto Mancini for this campaign to go well heading into the Euros, or it's very likely he will lose his job. He, of course, has credit in the bank after winning the Euros against us, of course. But, you know, are you expecting that Italy tonight will bring something that maybe England are just not expecting, caught a little bit cold? Because I want them to go out and play and express themselves the way that they did maybe against France in that quarterfinal in a 4-3-3. But going away from home to Italy in the first match of the campaign, are we maybe expecting a more pragmatic England set up to cope with an Italian wave?
Well, it sounds like it, because, you know, as Tom Roddy's written this morning, he's looking at playing Phillips and Rice in midfield with Bellingham in front of them. So that's quite conservative, and a slight concern in the fact that Calvin Phillips isn't actually playing very much for Manchester City at the moment. So I do think, you know, we know Italy are a good side. They obviously, you know, blew their qualification for the World Cup. I think they're going to be very dangerous opposition, and it's slightly bonkers that, you know, we are. It's the nature of being the England manager, but it already feels like Southgate's under a bit of pressure with this game, when it's actually the first game since the World Cup and since he decided to stay. And I still believe that that was a good decision for the FA, that was a positive step, that he's going to continue. I do think, for the most part, he's done an extremely good job. I do agree with the sort of widely held view that he's the best that England have had, you know, beyond Ramsey. So it's... You know, it's a strange situation where if he loses this evening, he could suddenly be under a lot of scrutiny again. But I think that is a distinct possibility. I think tonight, I think a draw for England is a very good result.
Are we all pro Gareth Southgate staying on and still being the England manager? Tom, I know you are.
I mean, I don't even need to answer, do I? Yes, of course.
Gregor, I know you're a Scot, but is this the right decision?
Of course, yeah. I can't believe you're still having that debate, to be honest. But I'm not surprised either.
Listen, I am not debating it. I am just outlining to the listeners where we stand on it, because there will be some who still feel like Gareth Southgate, you know, whatever it might be, substitutions, you know, England against the bigger teams, or his management of, you know, the high pressure, the biggest games that England have been in. There are still many that feel he has fallen short and is probably staying on as England manager because there are no better candidates or better available candidates. And I just wanted us to be clear that we feel like he is the right person for the job. This isn't a kind of default continuation of his contract. I also believe that Gareth Southgate is the best person for the job. And I think he has been an absolutely fantastic England manager. And look, I still feel like a lot of fans that, you know, there is more to come from this England team, but I do feel like they are on the right trajectory. And that's the most important thing. I think we are building under Southgate. You know, again, not to go over old podcasts, but you can't win every tournament. There can only be one winner. They have been very fitting winners of the tournament, even though England didn't win them. And I just feel like, you know, the next Euros could be it for us. You know, it's a young team, but it's an ever-improving team. I think Southgate is right at the helm.
What I would say, though, Hugh, on that is the reason it's still...
Oh, Matt's not Southgate.
No.
I should have asked him.
No. It's why it's still relevant, though, is because it is still an issue that divides opinion, you know, even on our own pages. You know, Henry Winter has been a pretty vocal critic of Gareth Southgate. And Henry's opinion is shared by a lot of the hardcore England fans. And mm-hmm. I guess my concern, if I, you know, if I was an England fan or if I worked at the FA, would be that Gareth was rattled by the criticism he received and the way the fans turned on him, particularly after that game at Molineux. And it will just be, it will be interesting to observe if this campaign starts with a slightly bumpy opening game. And it will be interesting to see how he deals with that. Now, he looked very calm last night. He was a bit spiky, according to the guys that were in the in the sort of press conference huddles. But I think you would find if you canvass the opinion of a lot of the fans who are here in Naples, they're not all big Gareth fans.
Gregor, from the outside looking in, I wanted to ask you about this. How much does that harm England generally, in your opinion? You know, you're an outside observer, but the spirit, unity, togetherness, how much does it, that harmony between the group of players, the coach, and then the fans matter?
Well, that's been interesting to kind of, to gauge the mood, actually, before the beginning of this qualification campaign, because as Matt alluded to, there were still some people who felt that the de facto response to going out in the quarterfinal to France, a game when they had 57% possession and twice as many shots as France, and they missed a penalty kick. Still, the de facto response should have been anger. Like that surprises me. But Matt's right to say that they're, you know, Henry Winter being one of them, and many fans still feel that way. I'm not sure that's ever going to change. And actually, been some interesting analysis too about almost Southgate is almost kind of his early success and kind of thrown off the burden of playing for England. You know, because there was no expectation then, actually. People, he after the Sam Allardyce sort of affair, and a guy who'd never really managed successfully in club football, he'd been involved in the 21, stepped into, he was, you know, someone just to step up and kind of take the reins on an interim basis initially. There was no expectation whatsoever, and what he's done is in turn built enormous expectation again. So I just don't think that he's ever going to be able to win. I think that even if he wins a tournament, there'd be some people who would say they would question the way it was done, or they would say this should have happened in past tournaments. It's England have a very talented group of players, but they don't have any kind of God-given right to win a tournament, and they don't actually have a better group of players than many other nations, many other top nations in Europe and the world. So I think that they find themselves in an interesting position. I think that Gareth Southgate, he has got to take another step forward. We have seen a step forward. All the conversation about conservatism and, you know, playing three at the back and whatnot, he took a step forward with that in the World Cup. He played 4-3-3. It was more attack minded, and I think possibly there is potential to take that forward again with the sheer quantity of attacking forwards, you know, wide players in particular that they have. So it's just going to be interesting to see his approach now, as you say, whether it's going to be to take that forward again and try and win in a style that will please more of the fans. I don't think that's kind of his start point, but I think we've seen progression in that regard already, and it'll be very interesting to see where England go from here.
Tom, your reaction to that?
I mean, my views on Gareth Southgate are well documented on this podcast. I agree with Gregor that there will be some England fans that will never be satisfied, because they are very proud of England and their football team, but also think that we have probably the best group of attacking players in world football. I don't agree with that, as Gregor says, but there is a case to be made that when you look at the Champions League, when you look at the Premier League, you look at some of the players in terms of people like Bukayo Saka, probably would be one of the most hotly desired players in European football at the minute. So from that point of view, there will always be people who will never be fully satisfied. What, to bring it back to tonight's game, what I think will be interesting is how attacking Southgate and England can be against a team like Italy. Obviously, we came unstuck against them in the Euro final. There's a piece on the website at the moment talking about how Italy and Mancini have changed their tactics. They've swapped back from a 4-3-3 system to a back three with wing backs, and how all their play goes through Marco Verratti in midfield, who had a big say in that final, of course, against England, dictating the play. It'll be interesting to see whether that kind of more attacking minded play that Southgate pushed at the World Cup, whether he can kind of push that again against a team like Italy, playing a back three with players like Verratti, who'll be looking to control and nullify England's young attacking talents. That is then, as Matt alludes to, that'll be where the early criticisms might start if we have a game where England don't score or have don't create many chances. That'll be the difficulty for Southgate.
Matt, just finally, what team, what approach are you expecting to see from England tonight?
Well, I'm relying on my colleagues, because, as I say, I've been more preoccupied with potential violence and Man United sales. But it sounds like he's going to go with Kane up front, looking to break that record finally. Saka and Grealish, Bellingham in behind. And then, as we said, Phillips and Rice. I think it's a massive shame that Rashford isn't here. I hope it isn't sort of a throwback to the days of Alex Ferguson when he would encourage being a kind word, his players to, with the slightest niggle, to pull out of international duty. Because I do think it is, it would be, Rashford's one of the informed players of the season, and it would be great if he was here playing with Kane, but he's not here. So that has slightly weakened England at the front, in my opinion. But Gareth is thinking, needs a bit of security, therefore two holding midfielders, but then we'll believe that with Bellingham, Grealish and Saka supporting Kane, he's got enough firepower.
Okay, Matt, enjoy the game. Thank you for joining us. Matt will be back a little bit later on with an update on Manchester United. So United fans, stay tuned for that. But thank you for joining us from out in Naples, cheers, Matt, and enjoy the game, as I say.
Cheers, guys. See you later.
So, what of Scotland up next? Their first two qualifiers for Euro 2024 are at home to Cyprus on Saturday. They then host Spain. That's after we next talk on Tuesday night next week. A couple of important matches to start the campaign, but really we need to test the waters as to where this Scotland team is. Of course, they got through to the World Cup playoffs. It ended in disappointment for them, but it's going to be an interesting group for Scotland. Scotland are in a group that, of course, includes Cyprus and Spain, who I just mentioned, but also Georgia and Norway. Remember, the top two teams go through, so it represents a good chance for Scotland, should I say, depending on what they can do against Norway and Spain, I guess. But listen, I feel positive about Scotland. It isn't always the case with Scotland fans, especially after that disappointment. Gregor Robertson, of course, with us, but also Michael Grant from The Times, of course, following Scotland everywhere they go. Michael, I wanted to ask you how really the Scottish football public are feeling about Steve Clarke and his team at this point in time. Are you currently in the mode of it's all about the Euros for Scotland? Really represents a good chance for you to get through to a major competition. And do you feel confident that Steve Clarke can deliver that?
Yeah, Hugh, I think I am quite positive about Scotland. And as you said, it is all about the Euro qualifying campaign for Steve Clarke and his team. You mentioned there, where are Scotland right now? And it's actually quite difficult to say, because they haven't played a competitive game since September. So, in terms of having a form guide, it's really difficult to know where they are. The last four competitive games were solid. They beat Armenia, they beat Ukraine 3-0, they beat Ireland 2-1, and then they drew away to Ukraine and Poland. All of those were good, solid results. And it meant they won their Nations League group. They were promoted to Group A. Dare I mention there was some pleasure in passing relegated England along the way.
You definitely may.
And it also secured a pot two seeding for the draw for these Euros. Now, that's been a little bit of a mixed blessing because, you know, really that ought to secure you a pretty favourable draw. But of course, we ended up getting Norway, who were the pot three seeds, and of course, a pretty formidable when Haaland's playing. So yeah, I mean, it is a pretty promising position because Hugh, they have a playoff place. You know, in reserve, should they not finish in the top two, they have a playoff place already secured. But it's difficult to get a handle on where the team stands because it's been so long since it's played together. One concern is the number of players who are either coming back from injuries or coming back from illness or have slipped a little at club level. And I'm thinking, you know, Kieran Tierney is not the starter that he was for Arsenal before Zinchenko appeared. McTominay's not starting as many matches now. Gilmore is struggling for minutes. And Dykes is just back from illness. And Nathan Patterson has been out for a while with a knee injury. So there are issues. Craig Gordon's out. And we'll maybe come to it. But Angus Gunn and Dominic Higham, the Blackburn centre-half, have been called up for the first time.
Well, no. Let's go to it straight away. This squad at the moment, and the quality they're in, and the depth as well, because I think that's the challenge. We've heard other managers of much bigger nations saying that they don't have enough players represented. I'm thinking namely of England and the percentages in the Premier League. I mean, that's a pretty privileged position to be in, especially when you look at those, you know, who are fit and available for Scotland at this point in time. The quality in the group, and maybe I'm thinking about the depth because that's what we're really alluding to, Scotland's ability to cope with issues which will happen along the way. Where is it at this point in time? And how much does it affect this team? I know you said we don't really know where this team is because they haven't played for so long. And of course, you're absolutely right on that. But equally, when you think about what we will see out there, what you're expecting to see from this Scotland team over the next couple of games, how would you rate it?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, there's a lot of experience there. John McGinn is on 52 caps. Callum McGregor of Celtic will get his 50th cap in these two matches. McTominay's almost at 40. Stuart Armstrong's almost at 40. Even Shea Adams, who, you know, only seems like 5 minutes since Shea Adams came into the picture, but he's on 22 caps, you know. So there is a kind of core of experience. Hanley's got 46. Robertson's got 60, Tierney's 35. So there is a body of experience, but there are also kind of areas in the side where we're lacking. I mean, none of the three goalkeepers in the squad have a single cap. So, you know, there's going to be a bit of a changing of the guard here from Anirov, Alan McGregor, then David Marshall and Craig Gordon. The three of those have really dominated the side for the last 20 years. Gordon's currently injured. Gordon might come back and play again later in the year, but for the moment, Angus Gunn, we think, is going to be the first choice. Another area that worries me, Hugh, is the lack of goals. I mean, Shea Adams has five, Christie's got five, and Lyndon Dykes has eight, but you know, we are a little over reliant on Adams, I think, who's been a good addition for Scotland, but he's not scoring many at club level for Southampton, and of course he might not be a Premier League player for that much longer.
What do you think about where Scotland are, Gregor?
I think Michael summed it up very well. I think that when you look at the squad, we're very well stocked in midfield, despite some of the issues that Mike alluded to in terms of players lacking minutes, particularly in the Premier League. I'm a well-stocked at wing-back, despite Nathan Patterson having not played much football and being injured. Centre-half and centre-forward, still for me, is a bit worrying. Liam Cooper's another who's not played at all, although personally I wouldn't, you know, I'm never that confident when he's on the team sheet anyway. Grant Hanley's back playing in the Championship. Ryan Porteous coming in. Got a move from Hibs to Watford is, you know, potentially one for the future. Aaron Hickey, who's missed a bit of football at Brentford, he's another option at right wing back. So, but it's up front. Michael's hitting the nail on the head when he said that the reliance now is on Che Adams, and he's a relatively recent addition to the squad. Lyndon Dykes has always been tireless in his running and his commitment, and he makes it really hard for opposition teams. And it's then about getting players like McGinn, Armstrong, if he's playing. It has been Ryan Fraser in the past. Players up around him, and you know, getting players forward in numbers to support him. But Che Adams is probably going to be the number one, and we're just lacking. We're lacking kind of cutting edge and goals, and that's been the case for quite some time. So look, Clark's always found a way to kind of get around that. Not always, but he's generally speaking, he's made the best of what he's got at his disposal, and I see no reason why that shouldn't continue. And as Michael said, we've got the backup card again, which means that we can go into this group, this qualifying campaign, and kind of have nothing to fear, really. Just to see, I think we're kind of playing for the future.
According to Stats Company, Nielsen's grace note, Scotland have a 42% chance of qualifying for Euro 2024 from this group, at 90% for Spain, the heavy favourite. But Norway's chances slightly better than Scotland at 44%. I mean, I would take the 42 if I was Scotland. I'd be absolutely delighted with that. As you mentioned, you got the backup as well. How important is it for Scotland to be in the next Euros, for Scottish football, for the future of Steve Clarke, of course? Is it the be-all and end-all, in your opinion, Michael?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, the nation and Clarke and the players took a lot and took an enormous amount from qualifying for the last Euros. I mean, it had been so long since Scotland had been at a major tournament. To do that again would give a sense of momentum after the massive blow of losing the World Cup qualifier to Ukraine. So, yeah, I think Clarke needs that. I do think that there is still a sense of momentum and moving forward with this group of players. I mean, it's not an old squad. It's not a squad that doesn't feel like it's still got a lot of potential in it. There are some interesting players that are beginning to become more prominent. I'm thinking there about Hickey, and I'm also thinking about Lewis Ferguson, who is out at Bologna. And, you know, I think he scored four goals in Serie A. He's even been linked with interest from Juventus. So Ferguson's going to be an interesting figure. I think he'll get a bit more game time in this campaign. And also Angus Gunn. It is an interesting one because he's a goalkeeper Scotland made approaches to before, and he basically hedged his bets to see if he would get a chance with England. I think he's realised that ship has sailed and he's made himself available to Scotland. We actually haven't seen that much of Angus Gunn, so it's going to be interesting to watch him. I can't believe that Clarke went all the way down to see him face to face and to talk him into it without privately saying to him, listen, you'll be the number one keeper if you commit to us. He denied that to us, but I'm pretty sure that must have happened because, otherwise, why would you go to such an effort? So, yeah, so those are interesting elements, I think, as we go into the new campaign. I think Scotland would beat Cyprus. Cyprus weren't particularly strong in the World Cup qualifying campaign, but you've then got Spain coming here to Hampden on Tuesday. We know what kind of game that's going to be. But Scotland are pretty strong at Hampden, by and large. I would say that they're pretty impressive. I hope that Gregor would agree that, obviously, Ukraine, the playoff defeat at Hampden was a sore one. But by and large, Scotland are pretty strong at Hampden in recent campaigns.
Yeah, and we've seen that in the crowds as well, I think. You know, it's the support I've got right behind Steve Clarke's team, so absolutely, it's there is still some forward momentum. As I say, having the kind of the safety net, if you will, of a place in the playoffs is huge. But momentum is kind of fragile. You still want to see a good showing in this campaign against some tough opposition. It's a tough group, no doubt about that, and. I just hope that we can continue to see some momentum built for the Euros.
Good good to see the way the fixtures have worked out for the Scotland fans as well. Little trip to Norway in June, home match against Georgia, Cyprus in September, lovely. Little bit of Spain in October. It's going to work out very nicely. I can see it. I can see it. And I'm hopeful that Scotland make it through, of course, because I'd love to see them at the next Euros and bring the Tartan Army, of course, on their travels to a major competition. Michael Grant, enjoy the game. I'm sure we'll speak to you on Monday after it as we look ahead to Scotland's next game. We can reflect on what we see from Steve Clarke and his side. Appreciate you joining us.
No problem. Thank you. Thanks, guys.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, a little bit earlier on the podcast, Matt Lawton joined us to discuss England out in Naples. He's with us once again, the magic of technology, to discuss Manchester United and some big developments regarding prospective new owners. Updated bids were meant to be in at the club today, and reports early this morning suggest that the bids that we thought were in weren't in, and those were from, I guess, the two most highly publicised parties involved in this. Which I think throws up a number of questions over the appetite to buy Manchester United, or at least the sum that we are expecting Manchester United to be sold for. So, Matt, please bring us up to date with where we are with Manchester United.
It's been a slightly bizarre 24 hours in that we were told there was a deadline that had been set by the New York bankers who were selling the club for United of 9 o'clock on Wednesday night. And ahead of that deadline, I think the majority of journalists who are covering this story were told by representatives acting for the two main bidders, that's the Qataris and the Ineos Group, that their bids were in. If you can imagine the scene, I was sitting with colleagues having a bit of dinner, working day done, and suddenly made aware that they're not in, and they weren't in. And actually, it transpired that on Tuesday, they asked for more time. Now, I'm not entirely surprised by that, because it was only on Thursday and Friday last week that the respective groups were given a tour of Old Trafford and the training ground and were given access to some of the books. So the idea that from Thursday or Friday, by Wednesday, you can then come up with a considered offer for £5 billion, I say, and you know, it's sort of beyond the comprehension of any of us, but you know, there's a lot to consider, and they asked for more time. But what caused the confusion was the fact that, and I'm not blaming the PR people that have been hired by these groups to do this, because I'm quite sure they're simply communicating what they're told to communicate, but the fact is we were given incorrect information, and there was a frantic scene in a restaurant in Naples, certainly in my case, of rewriting between editions last night. So, look, I do think those offers will come in the next 24 hours. I think the Ineos bid will go in this morning. It raises certain questions. And one of the questions it raises is why anyone linked to the United sale felt the need to actually clarify the situation. You know, because all it did was create a scene of embarrassment and confusion, and you know, it just begs the question: why they didn't just let it go, knowing that the bids were coming in, and just allow the papers and the, you know, broadcasters to be wrong for a few hours, if you like.
Do you think it tells us anything bigger about what's going on with this process, and I guess how valued Manchester United really is? Because we read some reports over the last few days about the desire of the Glazers to actually sell, whether it's just investment that they might be after. I know a lot of Manchester United fans kind of scared at the prospect that they won't get kind of glittery new owners coming in. But are we to read anything into this that maybe it might not be a full sale?
Well, I think it's a good question, and it's certainly a question that the bidders, some of the bidders, are asking. Because look, if we rewind back to November, Hugh, and back to, you know, we were all in Qatar, the World Cup, when the story broke that the club was for sale, and the guidance then was that the Glazers wanted 6 to 8 billion. That was before they knew exactly who was going to come in for this. And one of the things I think that United have been surprised by is the fact that it is, to our knowledge, only these two groups that are offering to buy the club in its entirety. The anticipated big bidder from America, the anticipated bidders from perhaps Saudi Arabia, from China, they haven't materialised. From Asia, they haven't materialised, and as a consequence, it's pretty much a two-horse race. There are other bidders who are looking to invest minority stakes. One of them is this American hedge fund, Elliott Investment Management, that, you know, they are offering to buy a minority stake as well as finance, provide finance for any of the other bidders. But it's not quite the sort of auction that they thought it was going to be. And as a consequence of that, we think that they value the club nearer to 5 billion. Now, it's still an enormous amount of money. It would still be a world record for a sports team. It still eclipses the $4.75 billion that the Walmart family paid for the Denver Broncos last year. But it's not as much as they wanted. And you start to wonder if, and particularly in light of the way things developed last night, if the Glazers might actually reject these offers and go instead for a minority investment. And that is definitely a concern. Now, I can say all this, and next week I'll be writing the Qatari bid has been accepted. So, you know, it's very hard to predict what's going to happen next, but I definitely think they are legitimate questions.
Okay, Matt, thank you for that update on Manchester United. And I guess we're going to come to more questions next week when we have time. But appreciate you bringing us up to date on where United are right now. So, Tom Clark and Gregor Robertson left with me. Apologies for that. It was interesting to hear Matt talk about, you know, that gap between the fans and the manager, possibly, particularly after England's poor run before the World Cup. But I think we should have learnt lessons from the World Cup. Firstly, as we saw in all four teams, in my opinion, in the semi-final, you don't have to be a great team to win a tournament. You don't have to be, you know, peak Barcelona under Guardiola. You don't have to be Brazil in 1970. You don't have to be a wonderful footballing side to win tournaments. You need to be extremely difficult to beat. And you need to have the ability to score goals. And I think England have that with their attacking quality. Defensive quality hasn't always been there. And he's been criticised for protecting, in his words, his players at the back and playing a more defensive style. But ultimately, Gareth Southgate has proven to be a very, very good England head coach. In my opinion, we were as good as any team. We were as well prepared as any team at that World Cup. I went to several Argentina games. They won the World Cup. You know, I still think England would have been good enough to beat that team on their day. France, okay, we're missing a number of players, a number of top quality players going into that World Cup. But ultimately, on the day, I think England played as well. And on another day, they could have gone through. You know, it was just the rub of the green on that day. I'm not sure what much more people can expect from an international team than what England have been showing of late. Particularly in tournaments. So in that regard, I'm as positive as maybe I've ever been as an England fan, maybe since 1996. And I just don't understand how other fans can't feel the same, to be perfectly honest. But anyway, it was interesting to hear Matt talk about what lineup it might be tonight as well, because it does feel quite pragmatic and relies, I think, when I look at the names there of Grealish and Saka, Bellingham, you know, okay, we know what Harry Kane can deliver, but it, you know, individual performances in an attacking sense will be key for England, I think. And that will be interesting to watch, Gregor.
Yeah, I mean, the dynamic of the midfield will be interesting, because it was, that was a sort of evolution that we didn't necessarily see coming at the World Cup, in terms of Rice basically playing as the sole holding midfielder and two more attack-minded players in front of him. And look, they're playing against a top opposition, so it wouldn't be a major surprise or anything to get angry about if that was tweaked slightly. And yeah, I think as I said, England have so many quality attacking players that it's always going to come down to a moment in time to decide who is best to play at that point. And Grealish is in fine form for City's best since he's moved to the club. And Saka, as Tom said, is scaling new heights. One of the best young players in Europe, absolutely. And Bellingham, there's several huge boosts as well. I mean, Bellingham is a massive, massive boost for Southgate and for England in midfield, because he does everything. He fills several roles. And I also think that Reece James is just his return is a huge boost. Yeah, Kyle Walker's been, you know, one of his most Southgate's most reliable performers, one of the most experienced players. He's versatile in that he can fill in a back, he can play on the right side of a back three. He's such an athlete that he can play as the wing back. He can play right side of a back four. But Reece James, I think, is the future. And there's always going to be, I think, also a temptation when you see the effect that Chilwell and Reece James have for Chelsea when they're in the team, as opposed to when they aren't. There's always going to be a temptation to kind of try and transfer that into the international setup, because what Reece, we've spoken a lot about, you know, Trent Alexander-Arnold and him kind of breaking new ground for what a fullback's output in an attacking sense. Reece James is sort of treading the more familiar fullback profile, that ground, if you like, better than anyone I can think of in world football. Basically, I think he's an outstanding player. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see Walker being the one who starts, but getting Reece James back involved would be another massive, massive boost, I think, for this England team, and a sort of nod towards the future. Because I did a piece about the you know, we've run a series of pieces looking at each area of the team, from goalkeepers, defenders, midfield and strikers throughout this week. And I did the one on defenders, and like, England are so well stocked at wing back. They've still got Rico Lewis, who's someone who could be someone who comes in by the time the Euros come round. Kieran Trippier and Kyle Walker are obviously, have been solid citizens, but they'll be 33 and 34 respectively by the time the tournament comes round. You've got James, Trent Alexander-Arnold will always be there in the background, but he seems quite far away at the moment. Chilwell and Shaw on the other side. And the big issue is centre-half. It's people will still be talking about Harry Maguire and whether it's right that Southgate's been so loyal to him, but given the poverty of options behind him, I think it's probably the right move. It's going to be interesting to see how long that loyalty can hold with Maguire not playing at Man United or indeed elsewhere next season. But that's probably the right decision at the moment. So I think more or less this is the best team that England can field.
Tom, what are your thoughts on this England team, what we've currently got at the moment, and where we might go before the Euros in terms of how we can develop things?
I think it's interesting. I'm glad Gregor mentioned our series, because it threw up an interesting point that he didn't mention. So often we get Time subscribers engaging with these pieces. And obviously, as we know, both for Game Podcast listeners and Time Sport readers, you get a lot of opinions from football fans. And it was interesting that with all these series, for example, Charlotte Dunker did a piece on the midfielders, and she discussed in a kind of more forward-looking way players like Harvey Elliott, maybe Joe Willock, and also referenced James Maddison, whether this will finally be his chance in kind of an attacking midfield role. And it's interesting that then that prompted comments from readers saying, what about James Ward-Prowse? This could be his time to kind of replace Jordan Henderson and things. And what was striking was that looking at all the pieces, it was Gregor's piece on the defenders that didn't really prompt many suggestions when it came to centre-back. So I do think that is a serious, serious issue. And I, you know, I've been a big fan of the back three system before under Southgate, and Gregor alludes to the option that that gives when you have the likes of Reece James and Chilwell. But I actually think after the success at times in the World Cup with the 4-3-3 that Southgate should persist down that road. I actually think if we've learned one thing from Gareth Southgate in his time, and one of his great successes as a coach of an England setup where you only get players for a short period of time, where you sometimes have to, you know, deal with club demands, players dropping out and things, is that he gets players to play for him on his merits, on his terms. And almost, yes, it's obviously important club form. Yes, it's important to be getting a run of games. But we saw it in the World Cup. We've seen it before. You could imagine a scenario where Harry Maguire will still put in a big performance for Gareth Southgate in an England shirt, even though he's struggling at Manchester United for form and time on the pitch. So that is the most interesting area of the pitch. But it wouldn't shock me at all to see Harry Maguire put in a good performance against Italy and continue to be a fairly central part of Gareth Southgate's plans, not just because there are so few options, but because he's a trusted member of the setup and Southgate's shown that he can always get plenty out of players on his terms, whether or not you're playing for your club or not.
I should just add, I did kind of like mention a few potential names for the future. If you look, Levi Colwill, who's on loan at Brighton, has had a very assured season, balanced with his, you know, being a left-sided central defender. Who knows, he might go back to Chelsea next season and try and force his way into some very crowded ranks there. But it's not impossible. Graham Potter was the man who signed him before he went the other way to Stamford Bridge in the summer. In the Championship, Taylor Harwood-Bellis has had a really good season for Burnley on loan from Manchester City. And, you know, like, things can change quite quickly. I think one way or another, he'll be playing Premier League football next season. Burnley are way clear at the top. They might try and get him back. He might go somewhere else in the Premier League because he's proven himself very capable in the Championship. I would say that stepping into Manchester City's team is a step too far at the moment. So things can change, but there's certainly no, like, outstanding candidates emerging at this moment to make it such a kind of a hard decision to understand to keep the faith with Maguire. I mean, people have referenced below the line in my piece, Dan Byrne, Lewis Dunk. Lewis Dunk's having a great season. I also mentioned Fikayo Tomori, who, you know, we all know can't seem to get his fourth cap despite owning a Serie A league winners medal and being in the quarterfinal of the Champions League. So there are one or two names you could throw forward, but they're not clear and obvious, if you want to put it that way. So I don't think people should be getting worked up about seeing Harry Maguire out on the pitch.
I would just come back on that, because I'm pleased you mentioned some of those names, and I agree. I think Levi Colwill could be a really classy player from what I've seen of him in his time at Brighton this season, particularly before he got injured. But I do think, you know, you make the point there that about going back to Maguire not being worried, and with some of those younger players that you list and think about the likes of Tomori, Mark Gay, you know, some of these players that we've touted on podcasts maybe 12 months ago, and could they be the people to displace Maguire? And they've shown that whether they've been in form or not, you know, Tomori particularly, a lot, there was a period, wasn't there, where the clamour on social media for him to get in was quite strong. But Southgate has shown that loyalty, and that's what I mean. I think Southgate shows that loyalty, and quite often players repay the faith. So I think, you know, I wouldn't be surprised, as I say, if Harry Maguire turns up and puts in some good performances for him.
Very quickly, and finally on England, Tom, can you countenance England losing tonight, and tell me about what the reaction would be?
I think you certainly can imagine England losing against Italy. I think thinking about all the things that Matt said, and, you know, Greg has talked about the kind of expectations, I think we're almost in a period now where whether you're either for Gareth Southgate, as I am, or you're, you know, sceptical of him, think he should have gone after the World Cup, it's as much about the type of performance that a team puts in. I think if, as I said earlier, if England were to lose maybe 1-0 in quite a kind of, dare I say it, drab game with lots of possession, based largely in midfield with not many chances created, that I think would be more damaging than, say, losing 3-2 in a game where England, you know, create a lot of chances. Saka looks incredibly dangerous, showing the form that he's shown for Arsenal all season. Grealish, again, like Gregor said earlier, shows the form that he showed this season. I think that would be, that's more important at this stage, I think, for Gareth Southgate. You know, he's been in charge a long time. Whatever you think of him, that's for perception purposes, that's what England are going to need to do. They're going to need to have a go. They're going to need to create chances and hopefully score a few goals. And if they do and then lose in a bit of a kind of thriller, oh, first international game back after the World Cup, I think that would be more manageable. A 1-0 dreary defeat where our two chances are long-range shots by Harry Kane, that might be a more difficult one to manage the message of, I think.
I know it's boring, but I just hope we've come to learn a little bit more about international football over the last few years and where it is right now. And this knee-jerk reaction to results is I think, the main thing that we just need to tone down a little bit. I think we had a good World Cup, but off the back of, you know, the Nations League games last summer, I think everyone was thinking England were in an appalling place. People were actually calling for Gareth Southgate to be sat before the World Cup. Then we get to a quarterfinal, as Gregor mentioned, performed quite well against France in the quarterfinal. Yes, we went out in the final eight, but ultimately, I think it had the draw gone our way. England would have definitely been a final four team, and who knows after that point in time. I think they were more than good enough. And yet you've still got people who are consistently reacting to any negative performance, you know, negative substitution, whatever it might be. You know, I do think we need to stop, you know, looking towards the negativity of before Gareth Southgate was England manager and carrying that with us. Yes, we've all got lived trauma as England fans. Obviously not as bad as Gregor's lived trauma as a Scotland fan, but you know, lived trauma as football fans that we think England should have done better. Yeah, I'm sorry, Gregor. And they haven't, right? And they haven't. But I think we need to just have a level head moving forward, because what we've seen is, you know, a tournament is a short period of time. You play well over those seven games and you can lift a trophy. It doesn't matter really what nation you're from. You can go and put your best foot forward. You can get to a semi-final and only win one game if you're Croatia, for example. So, you know, being a great side in international football doesn't really matter. Yes, there needs to be a certain level, but I think England are at that level. The rest is almost, you know, down to luck, down to the flip of a hat. You know, it's, you know, Argentina had the World Cup in their hands. Then they didn't, and then they won it, you know, and vice versa. It was out of France's hands completely. A few minutes of madness, they're back in it. You know, in another world, they're back-to-back world champions. You know, what could they take away from that World Cup? Disappointment, yes, but they were good enough, you know, and I think England were good enough. I think we showed against France that we were just as good as them. The game just didn't go our way. So please, this is me begging at the start of the campaign, even if we're second in this group, and we go and we qualify for the Euros behind Italy, that's okay. Okay, that is okay. As long as we're at this tournament.
Yeah, this is going to be clipped up big time.
Yeah, okay, all right. Well, listen, that's my optimism anyway. Who knows how long it will last. But, you know, it's a good squad with good players. And whether they, like I say, whether they win something or not soon, they are improving. They have raised the level. They are at a certain standard, and they're not really, in terms of their performances in international football, dropping beneath that. And that's for me, is a big change from where Gareth Southgate took over. That's all I'm saying, all right? If we draw 1-1 with Italy tonight, if we lose 1-0, you know, let's take it on the chin. Let's move forward. We got, you know, whatever it is, 9 other games to play or 8 other games to play or whatever it is. We'll be okay, right? We'll be okay. That's my positivity for now. Clip it up when we don't qualify, and I'm raging, okay? Because anything can happen in football still. Right, very quickly before we go, we need to talk about the retirement of, I don't know, an enigma? Was he a mercurial player? Mesut Ozil, whose character on the pitch, his statements off the pitch have made him, over the latter part of his career in particular, divisive figure. Maybe that's too strong, but someone who maybe split opinion among the fans. Some feel almost like he was a wasted talent throughout his career. But all we know is from what we saw, remember, he is a World Cup winner. He was a prodigious talent. He was an incredible playmaker. He was an absolutely fantastic footballer. And for me, it was very sad to see him retire. I think he's 34 years old. Would have loved to see him play a few more years and get back to a high level. But yeah, let's reflect on Mesut Ozil, but also for me, undervalued players in our sport. Not underrated, undervalued. And I'll come to my examples in a few moments' time, but very quickly, Tom Clark. Mesut, what a player.
Yeah, definitely. It was interesting seeing, as we often do, the outpouring of joy and compliments that come on social media when a player who has been incredibly divisive amongst football fans retires. It made me think slightly of Gareth Bale's retirement as well, in terms of the love and adoration that was coming out. But James Gearbrand's written an excellent piece on Mesut Ozil this morning, and I can't put it any better than this. It's easy to forget, with all the off-field dramas that he came to embody, that once he was a simply brilliant young footballer, a genius kid at Werder Bremen, the leading assist maker in Spanish football for three straight seasons at Real Madrid, and the poster boy of the Germany team that won the 2014 World Cup. So as you say, you know, and as James says there in the piece, you know, he really was, we talk about young talents like Bukayo Saka, Mesut Ozil was one of the world's best players at one point. And I think when he came to embody, you know, some of the problems at Arsenal, particularly with the big wages and things, but he also got 19 assists in the 2015-16 season, which was the year Arsenal could have won the title, were beaten by Leicester. That is third overall in Premier League, only behind Kevin De Bruyne in 2019-20 and Thierry Henry in 2002-03. So, you know, in terms of his output, it was definitely there. It was just that towards the end, the whole conversation around him got completely overshadowed. So I think in lots of ways, people saw him as a kind of old school footballer who, you know, the modern game with its fast paced pressing kind of slightly left behind. And that was another point James made in his piece. But in lots of ways, he very much embodied modern football in that he was incredibly skillful. His technical ability was often unmatched. You know, some of those goals that he scored where he would deliberately hit the ball into the floor in order to dink it over the goalkeeper. I mean, absolutely outrageous. Levels of skill and technique, but then, you know, he gets left behind by, you know, the conversation really in terms of how he's viewed and being at Arsenal at a difficult time. And I also reflected on, it's impossible to say, but you think about a player like Granit Xhaka at Arsenal, who for a while embodied that difficult time as well, and with the right coaching has been shown to be a brilliant top level European midfielder. And you wonder whether Mesut Ozil, you know, in his kind of few years before he left Arsenal, if he'd been under Mikel Arteta, what Arteta might have been able to do in terms of building the team around him, when you look at a player like Martin Ødegaard now. But absolutely incredibly technically gifted player, that's for sure.
I think when all said and done, Arsenal fans and many fans of the Premier League will just be forever grateful that he was here. Like, that's the truth. There was many, another line in James's piece, which is very good, was saying that he never, like, you know, despite all the, his, you know, his great season that Tom referenced in 2015-16, is, you know, all of, you know, he's an undoubted talent and gifts. He's saying that he never really consistently ascended beyond being a moments player. And I think there's some truth in that, and that you, particularly as Tom alluded to there, as football changed and it became more, you know, even more dynamic, and, you know, the high pressing kind of doctrine became the leading way of playing football in Europe. Basically, he kind of, I don't know, he didn't quite fit that, And so he did increasingly become reduced to a player who could produce incredible moments, and they were incredible. But there's always a kind of a feeling that when a player is deemed a luxury, and whether that's true or not was debatable for a long time. I think towards the end it kind of was true, but there's not really room for players that are perceived as luxury in modern football. No one could ever question his talent. I was reading he won the German Player of the Year award 5 times, which is more than any other player. And this is, as we've said, a Germany team that won the World Cup and was pretty supreme for a number of years. And he played all 7 games in that team that won the World Cup. So there can be no question in his talents. I don't even think we can question whether he fulfilled his potential either. He did. It's just that it didn't last perhaps quite as long as it could have. And part of that is to do with football changing around him. And part of that might be to do with some of the other things that we've spoken about in terms of how he felt he was treated by Germany. Not every player can play to their 37, like Luka Modric either, and reach the same level. So I think, as I said at the start, I think what we should all remember is the remarkable moments he produced, and be glad that he did so in the Premier League.
Yeah, I agree with you on that, Gregor. Brilliant player, maybe not the longevity of others, but certainly one who will go down in memory. On our undervalued players, Tom, who have you gone for?
Well, I'm not sure whether I'll get this by you, Hugh, as a Manchester United fan, but as it's International Week, I was thinking about England players who perhaps haven't been appreciated and weren't valued by their country. And I think about Michael Carrick an awful lot when it comes to England.
Absolutely. Nailed it.
You look at his record at Manchester United, he was part of that team that is so often cited with Rooney, Tevez, Berbatov, Ronaldo, but he was the linchpin. He was the guy who held it all together, won 5 Premier League titles, a Champions League, an FA Cup, played I think around 30 times for England. But I mean imagine if we had Michael Carrick alongside Declan Rice with Jude Bellingham in front of him now in England's midfield. I mean, we'd be we wouldn't have to be worrying about Marco Verratti in Italy, that's for sure. So he's a player that always pops into my mind when we think about undervalued players.
Mine is very similar. I've gone for Andy Cole for almost exactly the same reasons. You know, how can a player be, what is he now, 4th on the all-time list? Has Harry Kane overtaken him yet? But in terms of Premier League goal scoring, but a player who, when you mention him, you know, most fans' first reaction is to say that he missed a host of chances. Utterly ridiculous, absolutely fantastic striker with the medals to back it up, and totally undervalued by England, of course, but by many football fans as well. So I had to get him in.
Well, for a clean sweep of Manchester United players with a Scottish bent, I'm going for Darren Fletcher, who was undoubtedly undervalued by Manchester United for a long period of his career. I think, you know, people always reference as well the season where he was suspended for the Champions League final, and he kind of finally realised that the legs and the sort of energy and the work he does, which allowed other players to flourish, was invaluable. So I don't think that's true of Scotland. He didn't quite produce the same levels for Scotland, and it was in a different era. It was a more difficult time to be a Scotland player, to be honest, than it is now under Steve Clarke. But I think it took quite a long time for Darren Fletcher to get to be valued in perhaps the way he should have been.
There you go. Absolutely nailed it. 3 Manchester United players. Totally undervalued club, really, when you think about it. Just going back to...
£5 billion, yeah.
Exactly. £5 billion. Is that all? Unbelievable. So there you go. That's the theme of the podcast. We will be reacting to all of the international games between Thursday and Sunday, of course, when we meet on Monday morning, and looking ahead to Scotland's next fixture as well. Thank you all for joining me. Gregor, Tom, thank you for being with me, and to Matt Lawton for joining us as well. To all of you for listening, make sure you pick up The Game on Monday. You're going to have some brilliant articles after England's game against Ukraine on Sunday. But also, of course, make sure you're subscribed to the podcast. Hit the notification button, hit subscribe, and you will not miss an episode. If you want to subscribe online, of course, it's thetimes.co.uk/thegame. We'll see you on Monday. Take care.
now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.